My name is Michael McCusker. Before I get to the subject of this program, I'd like to apologize for my mispronunciation of several names at the Fisherman's Memorial on Memorial Day. I should have spent a little time studying the names and especially trying to get the right pronunciation of the Finnish names. I did upset some people, and I do apologize for that. And if indeed I'm ever asked back, I will be much more circumspect about learning my lines, you might say. And I guess I might say that yesterday would have been my father's 97th birthday. He died at the age of 84 in 1998. So wherever anything that might be left of him, chromosomes, whatever thing he might have transmogrified into, happy birthday, Dad, a day late. I'd like to read about Ursula K. Le Guin. I'd like to read a short story that she wrote. I might even have time for two. But first, I'd like to read what Wat Childress wrote about her for the Daily Astorian on May 25th, 2010. And as I'm sure many of you know, Wat owns Jupiter's Used Books in Cannon Beach, and he writes a column for the North Coast Citizen, which is a part of the Daily Astorian. Sister paper, I guess they call it. And by Wat Childress, master mythmaker tells some home truths. The Pacific West is a great place to explore the expanse of imagination. I was reminded of that reality on a bright spring Sabbath when I walked from my bookshop to the Cannon Beach Library to listen to Ursula K. Le Guin. Le Guin is a creative force of deep reckoning. At age 80, her body of work includes 50-plus books, novels, short stories, poetry, essays, and translations. Many have garnered awards and brought acclaim from the world's great wordsmiths. Commenting on the Portland resident's creative outpouring, Oregonian columnist Steve Dwin observed, quote, "If she is inspired by the view of Mount St. Helens, I'm sure the feeling is mutual." She certainly packed the children's room of the library with adults on Mother's Day weekend. Some traveled from as far away as Seattle to hear her talk titled Writing About Place. Le Guin is a local hero in the mythic sense. Her stories can stir something deep inside, a cellular inkling of what it meant to be alive when the earth was Eden. Place can give you a book, she said to the room, citing special examples in her work. One collection of short stories titled Sea Road, The Chronicles of Klatsand, came to her while at the little Cannon Beach cottage she owns, the same one she stayed at while teaching workshops with the Haystack Summer Program in the Arts. My favorite story in that book, a tiny piece titled Texts, features a woman immersed in the strange unceasing messages of her surroundings. Do I want to know what the sea writes? She thought. But at the same time, she was already reading the foam, which, though in vaguely cuneiform blobs rather than letters of any alphabet, was perfectly legible as she walked along beside it. And that was from Le Guin. Soft-spoken and unpretentious, Le Guin makes it easy to forget when she's sitting in front of you that she also stands in the company of master mythmakers. Her name is often listed along with J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, the professional duo from across the pond who cracked open Christendom's heart. Loving these authors as much as I do, it's tempting to imagine them all together at the same locus on the same time-space continuum. I'd especially like to see those Atlantic men meet Le Guin on her own Pacific ground. Since Tolkien and Lewis were keen on pubs, perhaps they might be enticed into one of our local taverns. Oh, to watch them hoist the frothy brew of King James spiced with European folklore. Methinks Le Guin could match those Oxford gents pint for pint with respect to her knowledge of canonical literature. Yet she could also show them how to sip the spirits of Native American tradition, distilled with Taoist spring water. After a round or two, the three could toast the Gospels and the Tao Te Ching, classic scriptures Le Guin translated in collaboration with J.P. Seaton, professor of Chinese at the University of North Carolina. They could discuss some dualities, child and parent, oral and written, the sword of self and the uncut gem of the soul. Then perhaps the profs could be lured outside, take a stroll beside the sea stacks with a local guide who groks a bit of their ancient language. A couple of wizards might even stretch their horizons, watch the green flash at sunset with a fiery, gentle archmage of the West. There was a time back east when the establishment burned her kind, yet Le Guin's recent talk at the Cannon Beach Library reaffirmed the truth that legends dwell among us, not merely as individuals, but as stories that play a superorganic role in shaping society. It's fallacious to think such stories can't be real if they're filled with fantastical elements, the stuff that's often called fantasy. Once upon a time, folks thought fairies were as factual as angels. It was as common to imagine a fire-breathing dragon as it was to envision the transfiguration of Jesus on the Mount. Part of me believes in all those things that many people abandon in childhood or see as purely symbolic. Who knows what life looked like in those elder days when the world was young, when holy tales were shared as gifts of creation rather than marketed as the canons of empire. Maybe we all do at a deep level that taps both primal human experience and our formative personal development. Le Guin conveys that potential as exquisitely as any writer I've read. She's conveyed it to me in her imaginative novels and short stories. She also discusses it in her book, Cheek by Jowl, Talks and Essays on How and Why Fantasy Matters. Fearful and suspicious as it is, the human mind yet yearns for a greater belonging, a vaster identification. And that's Le Guin. Imagining what could be, human beings might be moved to restore our place within creation, tend the proverbial garden, keep a common Sabbath, as it were. Given the pace at which our creeds of greed consume and pollute the planet, let's hope we find and share those imaginings very soon. Our chances are enchanted because Ursula K. Le Guin found a way to this mythic place. Magic comes where there's room for an uncut view. And that was by Wat Childress. Master Mythmaker tells some home truths. And it appeared in the Tuesday, May 25th, 2010 issue of the Daily Astorian. And now a little bit from Ursula K. Le Guin herself. This is from a book I've had for quite a long time, The Wind's 12 Quarters. And it's more or less some of her first short stories that she sort of compiled and has a few explanations about. And as she says in her foreword, this collection is what painters call a retrospective. It gives a roughly chronological survey of my short stories during the first 10 years after I broke into print, belated but undaunted at the age of 32. And she is now 80. And she gives a little bit of explanations before each story. And this one is called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, Variations on a Theme by William James. And her explanation for it. The central idea of this psychomyth, the scapegoat, turns up in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, and several people have asked me, rather suspiciously, why I gave the credit to William James. The fact is, I haven't been able to reread Dostoevsky, much as I loved him, since I was 25, and I'd certainly forgotten he used the idea. But when I met it in James's The Moral Philosopher and The Moral Life, it was with a shock of recognition. Here is how James puts it. Or if the hypothesis were offered us of a world in which Messrs., Fourier's, and Bellamy's, and Morris's utopias should all be outdone, and millions kept permanently happy on the one simple condition that a certain lost soul on the far-off edge of things should lead a life of lonely torment, what except a specifical and independent sort of emotion can it be which would make us immediately feel, even though an impulse arose within us to clutch at the happiness so offered, how hideous a thing would be its enjoyment when deliberately accepted as the fruit of such a bargain? And that's William James. Back to Le Guin. The dilemma of the American conscience can hardly be better stated. Dostoevsky was a great artist and a radical one, but his early social radicalism reversed itself, leaving him a violent reactionary, whereas the American James, who seems so mild, so naively gentlemanly, look how he says us, assuming all his readers are as decent as himself, was and remained and remains a genuinely radical thinker. Directly after the lost soul passage, he goes on. All the higher, more penetrating ideals are revolutionary. They present themselves far less in the guise of effects of past experience than in that of probable causes of future experience, factors to which the environment and the lessons it has so far taught us must learn to bend. Again, that was James, and back to Le Guin. The application of those two sentences to this story and to science fiction and to all thinking about the future is quite direct. Ideals as the probable causes of future experience. That is a subtle and an exhilarating remark. Of course, I didn't read James and sit down and say, now I'll write a story about that lost soul. It seldom works that simply. I sat down and started a story just because I felt like it, with nothing but the word Omelas in mind. It came from a road sign, Salem, Oregon, backwards. Don't you read road signs backwards? Potts, for stop. Walls, slow. Nirdhik, Osinanarf, Nas, Salem, equals Shlemo, equals Salam, equals peace. Melas, O Melas, O Melas. Where do you get your ideas from, Miss Le Guin? From forgetting Dostoevsky and reading road signs backwards, naturally. Where else? And so, the ones who walk away from Omelas. And by the way, she's expressing her beautiful view of politics, which she more or less calls revolutionary anarchy, in almost everything she writes. And you'll see a little bit of it in here. With a clamor of bells that set the swallows soaring, the festival of summer came to the city Omelas, bright towered by the sea. The rigging of the boats in the harbor sparkled with flags. In the streets between houses with red roofs and painted walls, between old moss-grown gardens and under avenues of trees, past great parks and public buildings, processions moved. Some were decorous. Old people in long, stiff robes of mauve and gray, grave master workmen, quiet, merry women carrying their babies and chatting as they walked. In other streets, the music beat faster, a shimmering of gong and tambourine, and the people went dancing. The procession was a dance. Children dodged in and out, their high calls rising like the swallows crossing flights over the music and the singing. All the processions wound towards the north side of the city, where on the great water meadow called the Green Fields, boys and girls, naked in the bright air, with mud-stained feet and ankles and long, lithe arms, exercised their restive horses before the race. The horses wore no gear at all but a halter without a bit. Their manes were braided with streamers of silver, gold, and green. They flared their nostrils and pranced and boasted to one another. They were vastly excited, the horse being the only animal who has adopted our ceremonies as his own. Far off to the north and west, the mountains stood up, half encircling Omelas on her bay. The air of morning was so clear that the snow, still crowning the 18 peaks, burned with white gold fire across the miles of sunlit air under the dark blue of the sky. There was just enough wind to make the banners that marked the race course snap and flutter now and then. In the silence of the broad green meadows, one could hear the music winding through the city streets, farther and nearer and ever approaching, a cheerful, faint sweetness of the air that from time to time trembled and gathered together and broke out into the great, joyous clanging of the bells. Joyous. How is one to tell about joy? How describe the citizens of Omelas? They were not simple folk, you see, though they were happy. But we do not say the words of cheer much anymore. All smiles have become archaic. Given a description such as this one tends to make certain assumptions. Given a description such as this one tends to look next for the king, mounted on a splendid stallion and surrounded by his noble knights, or perhaps in a golden litter borne by great muscled slaves. But there was no king. They did not use swords or keep slaves. They were not barbarians. I do not know the rules and laws of their society, but I suspect that they were singularly few. As they did without monarchy and slavery, so they also got on without the stock exchange, the advertisement, the secret police, and the bomb. Yet I repeat that these were not simple folk, not dulcet shepherds, noble savages, bland utopians. They were not less complex than us. The trouble is that we have a bad habit, encouraged by pedants and sophisticates, of considering happiness as something rather stupid. Only pain is intellectual, only evil interesting. This is the treason of the artist, a refusal to admit the banality of evil and the terrible boredom of pain. If you can't lick 'em, join 'em. If it hurts, repeat it. But to praise despair is to condemn delight, to embrace violence is to lose hold of everything else. We have almost lost hold. We can no longer describe a happy man or make any celebration of joy. How can I tell you about the people of Omelas? They were not naive and happy children, though their children were in fact happy. They were mature, intelligent, passionate adults whose lives were not wretched. Oh, miracle! But I wish I could describe it better. I wish I could convince you. Omelas sounds, in my words, like a city in a fairy tale, long ago and far away, once upon a time. Perhaps it would be best if you imagined it as your own fancy bids, assuming it will rise to the occasion, for certainly I cannot suit you all. For instance, how about technology? I think that there would be no cars or helicopters in and above the streets. This follows from the fact that the people of Omelas are happy people. Happiness is based on a just discrimination of what is necessary, what is neither necessary nor destructive, and what is destructive. In the middle category, however, that of the unnecessary but undestructive, that of comfort, luxury, exuberance, etc., they could perfectly well have central heating, subway trains, washing machines, and all kinds of marvelous devices not yet invented here, floating light sources, fuelless power, a cure for the common cold. Or they could have none of that. It doesn't matter, as you like it. I incline to think that people from towns up and down the coast have been coming to Omelas during the last days before the festival on very fast little trains and double-deck trams, and that the train station of Omelas is actually the handsomest building in town, though plainer than the magnificent farmer's market. But even granted trains, I fear that Omelas so far strikes some of you as goody-goody. Smiles, bells, parades, horses, blah. If so, please add an orgy. If an orgy would help, don't hesitate. Let us not, however, have temples from which issue beautiful nude priests and priestesses already half in ecstasy and ready to copulate with any man or woman, lover or stranger, who desires union with the deep godhead of the blood, although that was my first idea. But really it would be better not to have any temples in Omelas, at least not manned temples. Religion, yes. Clergy, no. Surely the beautiful nudes can just wander about offering themselves like divine souffles to the hunger of the needy and the rapture of the flesh. Let them join the processions. Let tambourines be struck above the copulations and the glory of desire be proclaimed upon the gongs and, a not unimportant point, let the offspring of these delightful rituals be beloved and looked after by all. One thing I know there is none of in Omelas is guilt. But what else should there be? I thought at first there were no drugs, but that is puritanical. For those who like it, the faint, insistent sweetness of druze may perfume the ways of the city. Druze, which first brings a great lightness and brilliance to the mind and limbs, and then after some hours a dreamy languor and wonderful visions of at last of the very arcana and innermost secrets of the universe, as well as exciting the pleasures of sex beyond all belief, and it is not habit-forming. For more modest tastes, I think there ought to be beer. What else? What else belongs in the joyous city? The sense of victory, surely, the celebration of courage. But as we did without clergy, let us do without soldiers. The joy built upon successful slaughter is not the right kind of joy. It will not do. It is fearful and it is trivial. A boundless and generous contentment, a magnanimous triumph, felt not against some outer enemy, but in communion with the finest and fairest in the soul of all men everywhere, and the splendor of the world's summer. This is what swells the hearts of the people of Omelas, and the victory they celebrate is that of life. I really don't think many of them need to take Druze. Most of the processions have reached the green fields by now. A marvelous smell of cooking goes forth from the red and blue tents of the provisioners. The faces of small children are amiably sticky in the benign gray beard of a man. A couple of crumbs of rich pastry are entangled. The youths and girls have mounted their horses and are beginning to group around the starting line of the course. An old woman, small, fat, and laughing, is passing out flowers from a basket, and tall young men wear her flowers in their shining hair. A child of 9 or 10 sits at the edge of the crowd alone, playing on a wooden flute. People pause to listen and they smile, but they do not speak to him, for he never ceases playing and never sees them, his dark eyes wholly wrapped in the sweet, thin magic of the flute. He finishes and slowly lowers his hands, holding the wooden flute. As if that little private silence were the signal, all at once a trumpet sounds from the pavilion near the starting line, imperious, melancholy, piercing. The horses rear on their slender legs, and some of them neigh in answer. Sober-faced, the young riders stroke the horses' necks and soothe them, whispering, "Quiet, quiet, there, my beauty, my hope." They begin to form in rank along the starting line. The crowds along the race course are like a field of grass and flowers in the wind. The festival of summer has begun. Do you believe? Do you accept the festival, the city, the joy? No? Then let me describe one more thing. In a basement under one of the beautiful public buildings of Omelas, or perhaps in the cellar of one of its spacious private homes, there is a room. It has one locked door and no window. A little light seeps in dustily between cracks in the boards, secondhand from a cobwebbed window, somewhere across the cellar. In one corner of the little room, a couple of mops with stiff, clotted, foul-smelling heads stand near a rusty bucket. The floor is dirt, a little damp to the touch, as cellar dirt usually is. The room is about 3 paces long and 2 wide, a mere broom closet or disused tool room. In the room, a child is sitting. It could be a boy or a girl. It looks about 6, but actually is nearly 10. It is feeble-minded. Perhaps it was born defective, or perhaps it has become imbecile through fear, malnutrition, and neglect. It picks its nose and occasionally fumbles vaguely with its toes or genitals as it sits hunched in the corner, farthest from the bucket and the 2 mops. It is afraid of the mops. It finds them horrible. It shuts its eyes, but it knows the mops are still standing there, and the door is locked, and nobody will come. The door is always locked, and nobody ever comes, except that sometimes, the child has no understanding of time or interval, sometimes the door rattles terribly and opens, and a person or several people are there. One of them may come in and kick the child and make it stand up. The others never come close, but peer in at it with frightened, disgusted eyes. The food bowl and the water jug are hastily filled. The door is locked. The eyes disappear. The people at the door never say anything, but the child, who has not always lived in the tool room and can remember sunlight and its mother's voice, sometimes speaks. "I will be good," it says. "Please let me out. I will be good." They never answer. The child used to scream for help at night and cry a good deal, but now it only makes a kind of whining, "Yeah. Yeah," and it speaks less and less often. It is so thin there are no calves to its legs. Its belly protrudes. It lives on a half bowl of cornmeal and grease a day. It is naked. Its buttocks and thighs are a mass of festered sores as it sits in its own excrement continually. They all know it is there, all the people of Omelas. Some of them have come to see it. Others are content merely to know it is there. They all know that it has to be there. Some of them understand why, and some do not, but they all understand that their happiness, the beauty of their city, the tenderness of their friendships, the health of their children, the wisdom of their scholars, the skill of their makers, even the abundance of their harvest, and the kindly weathers of their skies depend wholly on this child's abominable mystery. This is usually explained to children when they are between 8 and 12, whenever they seem capable of understanding, and most of those who come to see the child are young people, though often enough an adult comes or comes back to see the child. No matter how well the matter has been explained to them, these young spectators are always shocked and sickened at the sight. They feel disgust, which they have thought themselves superior to. They feel anger, outrage, impotence, despite all the explanations. They would like to do something for the child, but there is nothing they can do. If the child were brought up into the sunlight out of that vile place, if it were cleaned and fed and comforted, that would be a good thing indeed. But if it were done in that day and hour, all the prosperity and beauty and delight of Omelas would wither and be destroyed. Those are the terms. To exchange all the goodness and grace of every life in Omelas for that single, small improvement. To throw away the happiness of thousands for the chance of the happiness of one. That would be to let guilt within the walls indeed. The terms are strict and absolute. There may not even be a kind word spoken to the child. Often the young people go home in tears or in a tearless rage when they have seen the child and faced this terrible paradox. They may brood over it for weeks or years, but as time goes by, they begin to realize that even if the child could be released, it would not get much good of its freedom. A little vague pleasure of warmth and food, no doubt, but little more. It is too degraded and imbecile to know any real joy. It has been afraid too long ever to be free of fear. Its habits are too uncouth for it to respond to humane treatment. Indeed, after so long, it would probably be wretched without walls about it to protect it, and darkness for its eyes, and its own excrement to sit in. Their tears at the bitter injustice dry when they begin to perceive the terrible justice of reality and to accept it. Yet it is their tears and anger, the trying of their generosity and the acceptance of their helplessness, which are perhaps the true source of the splendor of their lives. Theirs is no vapid, irresponsible happiness. They know that they, like the child, are not free. They know compassion. It is the existence of the child and their knowledge of its existence that makes possible the nobility of their architecture, the poignancy of their music, the profundity of their science. It is because of the child that they are so gentle with children. They know that if the wretched one were not there sniveling in the dark, the other one, the flute player, could make no joyful music as the young riders line up in their beauty for the races in the sunlight of the first morning of summer. Now do you believe in them? Are they not more credible? But there is one more thing to tell, and this is quite incredible. At times, one of the adolescent girls or boys who go to see the child does not go home to weep or rage, does not in fact go home at all. Sometimes also a man or woman much older falls silent for a day or two, then leaves home. These people go out into the street and walk down the street alone. They keep walking and walk straight out of the city of Omelas, through the beautiful gates. They keep walking across the farmlands of Omelas. Each one goes alone, youth or girl, man or woman. Night falls. The traveler must pass down village streets, between the houses with yellow-lit windows, and on out into the darkness of the fields. Each alone. They go west or north towards the mountains. They go on. They leave Omelas. They walk ahead into the darkness, and they do not come back. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the city of happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible that it does not exist, but they seem to know where they are going, the ones who walk away from Omelas. And that was The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin. She wrote it in 1973, and it originally appeared in New Dimensions. And my name is Michael McCusker.